Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands, hands high.
Don't stop.
Wave your hands, hands high.
All right, welcome back to North Texas Music Fanatics. I am Jason Janik. We got another great episode about to start. I'm excited because this one we are doing in the Deep Ellum Community Center down here in Deep Ellum. Figured it would be a fun place to try out. Man, it's great looking around this place and seeing all the history that Deep Ellum has. Quickly, don't forget to join Instagram. Don't forget to join Patreon, even if you don't join at a paying level. Look us up, NTXMF, and join the fun. New episodes every week, as long as I can keep this up. It's challenging, but man, it's fun doing this because we are talking with some people who know about North Texas music. And this one's a little different, but it's a little special because I don't think we've had anybody who's actually run a club on the show yet. It's mostly been musicians or somebody who's handled marketing and PR, somebody who handled merch, you know, all the people surrounding the clubs. But this is our first chance that we get to hear a new side of things. Let's hear from Russell Hobbs.
Russell Hobbs.
That's right. I usually start at the beginning, but I think it would be a lot more fun to start with your favorite memory from one of your places.
Favorite memory from one of my places.
I know you've got a lot of good ones.
You're talking about like music venues, like
yeah. Tell everyone the places that you ran.
Oh, okay, yeah. So the Theater Gallery, we opened in 1984 in Deep Ellum. It was pretty much a ghost town. And the Profit Bar, we opened a year later because we got busted for bootlegging over at the Theater Gallery at the TG. So we opened a legitimate bar, the Artistic Saloon for the sake of money, which, you know, it was like you could buy drinks and see really eclectic blend of awesome music there. So it sort of financed the radical art scene at the Theater Gallery. And then later I had a place called The Door with a 20-year run. The Door opened in 98. In 98, you know, Deep Ellum sort of had another rebirth with the Door and then the Gypsy Tea Room. And, I mean, we had everybody. At the Door, we had Dua Lipa's first show in Dallas, the Lumineers' first show in Dallas. We did everybody. What's my favorite memory? Boy, that's tough. I'm going to...
Well, let's come back to that then. Let's let that question kind of ruminate in the back of your head. We'll let it kind of bubble up. How about now you tell us... How do you start the Theater Gallery? How does that happen? Because back then, like you said, this was nothing. This was not the scene that we know today.
You know, there's a lot of different club owners, venue type owners. I mean, I didn't premeditate my crimes. Basically, I was looking to escape the materialistic Dallas. I didn't really want a shiny car and a shiny suit and work in a big shiny building. So I kind of dropped out of college again and went down to lease a warehouse and open a gallery and book bands that were just friends, you know. So it was an escape of Dallas. And Deep Ellum, there was nothing there really but some, you know, brake shops and a butcher shop. And Adair's moved in 84.
Okay.
At exactly pretty much the same time we moved in. And we started an art gallery and started booking bands to play parties and have fun. And it really just became a music venue business as it progressed. It was not premeditated, like, oh, let's write up a business plan and go get a place and do a music venue to make money. It was quite the opposite. It was, you know, myself and a guy, Tracy Smith, he was a friend of mine, and then Logan Daffron, and, you know, we opened the gallery with some painters from North Texas State. Janet Kuttner wrote a story about the gallery night. You know, we were a big splash, you know.
Was color. North Texas, is that where you were at the time? You said you dropped out?
I had dropped out of school in Denton, right? Because In Denton, it was like you had all the dudes smoking weed, you know, in the music school. And then you had the Greeks throwing frat parties. And Denton wasn't much of a scene in 82 or 3. So I came to Dallas and brought some artists together that I met that were these avant-garde, edgy, really fine arts, you know, renegades. And we showed there in 84, September. So that art opening made a splash. And then other artists sort of came out of the woodwork, and I met a lot of people like Ron English,
sure,
Bill Havron, you know, and we started showing really cool stuff in the gallery. So the theater gallery was this tremendous convergence of superb painters and great bands like Zeitgeist and Three on a Hill, The End, you know, Reverend Horton Heat later. And it was, it just kind of blew up in 84. And then 85, we were going, that was 6 or 8 months. And, you know, all of a sudden I met Mark Lee of 462. And then Jeff Lyles comes in one day to book his band. And I said, hey, yeah, man, let's look at the calendar. Let's book your band. And then he comes back a week later and goes, dude, my band broke up. And I'm like, well, why don't you help me book, you know, help me book the club. Because we talked about bands. And
yeah,
he got the vision, you know. And so, you know, now Jeff tells the story. It was my idea to say, hey, help me book. I thought it was like him saying, dude, let me help you book this place. But either way, so we were the dynamic duo. Deep Ellum completely changed. 462, Danny Eaton and Mark Lee were sending us the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jane's Addiction, the Smithereens, before everybody knew who they were.
Yeah, I've heard Jeff's stories about Chili Peppers, and I'm so... I don't know how to put it, but I so wish I could have experienced Deep Ellum not only the way that I did, but the way that you did, because I know the stuff that you've said and the stuff that Jeff has said, it's just such a special, unique part of music history.
It was a very beautiful moment of sort of innocence, 84 and 85 in Deep Ellum. It wasn't at all commercially motivated. It was really convicted, hungry artists wanting to get their painting out, wanting to just write a song. I mean, Tench Cox and David Mabry of The End and Kevin, you know, they're just kids bringing their original music, and then brought 300 friends from Highland Park High School, you know, on a weekend night to see them. And Three on a Hill, you know, just the tragic and beautiful music that Peter Schmidt, you know, tore his soul stage to create.
Well, every incarnation of his art has been something special. I can't remember a single show that I've seen of his that people were just not in awe.
Yeah, and the atmosphere that we created with Theater Gallery, the philosophy was you can show whatever painting you want as long as it's good, and you can play whatever music you want. We weren't there to sell tickets or sell beer. We were just there to really experience it ourselves. And so we also had avant-garde theater. You know, all these people that went on to do great things in the theater scene pretty much all started there at that moment. And so you'd go and see an art opening and be inspired and challenged by the art. And then we'd have a play, and it was crazy stuff. You know, Scott Matthews, Brooks Tuttle, Kurt Kleinman, Catherine Owens, Bruce DuBose, all these people that were very maverick, theatrical type people. Cardi Talkington, he was an actor, went on to be a director in Hollywood, discovered Renee Zellweger. You know, we were there just creating a scene to break on through and not be part of Dallas. It started to be really popular because everybody come from all the high schools. I mean, whether you were an artist looking for an outlet or you were a kid digging the arts, you came from everywhere and converged on the weekends.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was curious, do you think that was a spark for so much of what happened after that? Because I know a lot of people don't think about the fact that Deep Ellum had theater troupes in it during the 90s. They had spaces like, was it Undermain that was down here?
Yes.
I mean, did all that spark from the stuff that you and these peers of yours created?
Well, Undermain was Catherine Owens and Bruce DuBose. Bruce DuBose, I think that's how you pronounce his name. I would say it like this. Sometimes there's a certain zeitgeist of the moment where the establishment runs theater. Dallas had clubs with cover bands, and Dallas had Dallas Theater Center, and Dallas had, you know, some galleries with some boring art that sold for too much money. But it was a moment in time where there were many inspired people in all disciplines of the arts that had no place to do their thing. So when we opened up, everyone came out of the woodwork, whether it was original bands started forming at high schools or painters spreading the word, oh man, there's a gallery that'll show your stuff. It's not about, you know, you don't have to be somebody to be somebody. So it was really an open door, and it just a vacuum just got sucked in full, you know.
Yeah, it pulled in everybody that didn't have a place somewhere else.
Yeah, and so to answer your question, it certainly was the springboard for a lot of theater troupes that went and got their own house, let's say, or bands. You know, Jim Heath was the sound guy at Theater Gallery, and then he's going through a divorce and writing songs about, you know, his wife and his heartbreak. And I was like, dude, you got to get on the stage at the Profit Bar. Oh, man, I don't have a band. I was, who cares? We just want to hear your guts come out, you know? So that's where people find their destiny, is where there's liberty to do your thing and not try to, not, no one's forming you. Oh, you don't have to be like The Cure. You don't have to be like, you know, this band or that. And it's not about money. It's about what's inside of you. And so those people become the innovators because they have a stage to do it on.
And I realize this is a music-focused podcast, but I just felt like with you mentioning the stage and the actors down here, I mean, those are kind of like the brothers or the cousins of the music stage. Just the same way that the restaurants that were down here, they are kin to the nightclubs and the bars.
That synergy that happened at Theater Gallery, you know, Jim Heath, Reverend Horton Heath, will tell you that he was so influenced by the art gallery and different galleries like Eugene Binder Gallery and other galleries in the Deep Ellum area that it sort of formed his songwriting and his character of Reverend Horton Heath. And I think a lot of the artists will do all mention that the when you bring the visual art and the musical art, and then theater, of course, is, you know, super complex art form.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, who can describe what theater is? You know, you're acting out something with your full being on stage. So the fact that they were all going on together, everyone learned from each other and was inspired. And, you know, people like Rhett Miller, the New Bohemians, all these acts came out of that scene. And then that was that first generation. And so what you get is, you know, when Tench Cox was standing in the audience watching Zeitgeist, and then he became The End, and then you got kids like Clark of the Toadies that was standing in the same room watching Three on a Hill, and he became Clark of the Toadies. So
And in between that, he was Clark in Funland.
Very good point.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like when you watch people and they inspire you and influence you, and then you grow into what you become. It's sort of like you're on the shoulders of the generations before you.
Exactly.
To create the art it is today.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Rhett and you bring up New Bohemians, because like you said, you started in 84, and by the time you get to, let's say, New Bohemians, I mean, that's late 80s. So you had already had the scene up and running. It had already snowballed by that point, correct? What are we seeing down in Deep Ellum? What are we seeing that you're involved with by the time we hit like 89, 90?
Well, in 1984, we opened Theater Gallery with the art gallery and a Zeitgeist show and The End and even a band, Robert Lee Cobb, you know, like a Bruce Springsteen style copy band, band.
I think I've got one of his records. I found it at a thrift store, and it's fun.
Yeah, it's a super cool guy. And so in 85 is when really the local bands came out of the woodwork. You know, Three on a Hill and other bands like that. And then, so it just thickened as you go through the months.
Sure.
Right? 85, we started getting all the touring bands from 462. And just, you know, like Jeff got the Flaming Lips book the first time. And, you know, so it just started growing quickly. And to answer your question, by 86, we had the two clubs and we did a record label. And then, so Clearview came in and you had Jeff Swaney and Mark Cuban, you know, sweeping homeless out of a warehouse to throw a keg party and meet chicks, by their own confession. And so Clearview brought another layer in late 85 of sort of the more dance party scene crowd, which at the moment we sort of despised it because we were the purists. You know, we were, it's all art, man. You know, it's got to be real. But they brought a whole nother level of crowd, and the masses started kind of coming down. And so it was cool because Clearview was still cool in the fact that they started booking bands. I mean, they started off as sort of this kind of dancey, you know, party thing that we weren't hip to, you know, but then they started booking bands too. And it was a pretty cool thing. So at one time you had the Theater Gallery, the Profit Bar, and Clearview. Then Video Bar on the air moved from Greenville Avenue, you know, Bart Weiss and all those guys. And the Video Bar was super cool, well budgeted, high tech, state of the art, you know, visual experience. And then I guess Dada, you know, so Darren Blanton was the realtor guy out shagging people to get them in for, you know, he brought in Dada and Trees came later. So actually it got to the point where it just every 6 months you'd have like three new clubs. And so I'd say in 88, 89, it was already pretty thick. There were probably 20 venues, you know, On the Rocks, Deep Ellum Live, and of course all the restaurants too, you know. So it became a complete commercial universe within 3 years.
Well, I got to say that is amazing to listen to, because that's before my time. My first foray down into Deep Ellum was 93, and to know how it developed, it just gives me even more of a sense of community in a way. I think now would be a good time to hear one of the bands that you mentioned. Do you want to play some Horton Heat? What do you want to hear?
Oh, man, I love all this stuff. You got Big Little Baby, or you got Loaded Gun. It's whatever you want, man.
All right. I know that we'll get into this in a little bit, but I know before we started recording, we mentioned that you have a few bands that recorded some stuff for a documentary you're working on. Why don't we hear one of those bands? Pick one, and I'll hit play. Who do you think?
Reverend Horton Heat, The End.
Oh, The End. Yeah, that'll be a great one, because cool. Like you said, The End was here in the beginning, right? So let's hear The End. Here we go.
Come on.
That was pretty great. I have not heard that band before. Like I said, you know, I started down here in 93, and I always love discovering stuff that I just was not real familiar with before. That's the beauty of Deep Ellum, is there's so much great music. Man, just, I mean, looking around out here right now, it's noisy. I've heard a few cars pass by. It's busy. I see people walking down the street with their dogs, but that's the beauty of it, and you've been down here for so much of it.
Yeah, like I said, I moved in here just to escape the Dallas thing. I never really fit in the sort of materialistic society, so I came down here looking for just to create my, you know, do my own paintings and have a big space to live in, do a gallery, and book some bands just for fun. And it's what happened is so many like-minded people converged that we just created a Woodstock every week, basically.
Yeah, it felt like that for quite a while, for sure.
It was Woodstock every week from probably 84 into about 89.
I'd go past that. I mean, granted, you had a different experience than I did, but when I was down here in 93 and my friend and I would walk the sidewalks and hear the bands, you know, I couldn't even afford to get into one of the clubs back when I was 18, but you could still hear them through the walls outside, and just seeing people enjoying themselves and the buskers and the guys that did backflips for a dollar and just everything. It felt very, like you said, kind of hippie, kind of just like a big family party.
It was a real community. It was a rich cultural community. And what is beautiful still, Deep Ellum's still the most cultural, colorful part of Dallas.
That's true.
I mean, Oak Cliff's better now than ever. I shouldn't say that. I'll say Oak Cliff's still great and a cultural center.
I do love Bishop Arts. I think that it's a really nice balance of commerce and creativity.
Yeah, but the Deep Ellum reality, there's a destiny about this neighborhood. It's 150 years now that people that are set free,
yeah,
converge, because when slavery was abolished, Deep Ellum became a place where the black community called their own, and with Jewish landlords and Greek immigrants and, you know, cotton picking white boys or whatever, they all created a community together here with music and theater and just what people do. And it was a little rough, but it was cultural and edgy and cool, and it grew and grew. And then in the 20s and 30s, there was a legitimate blues scene here.
100%.
The Deep Ellum blues was part of a circuit where, if you know the song, going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. So the circuit was like Kansas City, Deep Ellum, New Orleans, Jackson, Memphis. And I may be leaving out one of those towns, but the blues circuit was looped into Deep Ellum. So you had, you know, Huddy Leadbelly, Lightnin' Hopkins, Blind Lemon Jefferson, all them cats, and it was such a scene.
And there's a reason why Robert Johnson recorded in Dallas. He didn't just happen upon Dallas.
No doubt. And so, big picture, I'm trying to get back to this point, is there's a thing about Deep Ellum that it's like a magnet that draws people. And there's a thing about liberty. When you say, hey, you can do your art here the way you want to do it, and you can sing your song the way you want to sing it, and we're not going to try to fabricate and manipulate you into a product, there's a liberty there. So that's the thing. For 150 years, the banner over Deep Ellum has been liberty. And that's what our venues were all about back in the 80s.
Yeah, before we started recording, you and I had talked a little bit about the deep history of this area. I know that some of that early stuff kind of has a special place in your heart. Do you think it's just, is it because those people had the same spirit as what you wanted to do in the 80s?
I think it was just a moment in time where everybody was hungry to break away from the status quo. You know, Dallas was JR, you know, the South Fork Ranch TV show, the show Dallas, in fact.
And Reunion Tower, Glitz.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was Dallas was a cool city, but there wasn't a lot of outlet for individuality or, say, you know, avant-garde arts. It was more of a city that sort of followed the trends of New York or L.A. or something like that. Although, I mean, Dallas did have this very unique sort of oil man, you know, cowboy, millionaire vibe, which was cool, but it didn't do a lot for the artists, you know. So I think that was just the zeitgeist of the day, was that people were looking for a way to be expressive and be real and, you know, kind of find out who they were. So it was a perfect storm where we just kind of opened a place, and then it opened the city. The Deep Ellum opened up, you know, from the venues, and then the city came here. And what's cool is there was a sort of a phase of, like, say, 84 to 88, and then they're kicked in another whole phase, you know, to the early 90s. And the scene got really thick. And then you had all, you know, all these really great touring bands continuing and bigger shows. And then all these, another wave of original acts that came out of Deep Ellum.
Yeah.
So you had the first batch, it was, say, on the Island Records sound of Deep Ellum.
Yep.
You know, that compilation with Legendary Revelations, you know, guys that played in the 30s down here were actually on a record with Three on a Hill, Reverend Horton Heat, the New Bohemians, The End, you know, the Daylights and Loco Gringos. And then you had this other wave in the early 90s that you experienced, and that was just a bunch of cool bands. So it's like almost like every 5 years, there's this sort of new peak of original acts that have exploded out of Deep Ellum. And I think you've got to attribute some way, that's got to be attributed to the neighborhood itself.
Yeah, you know, the birth of Deep Ellum has always held on to that core.
Yeah, because, you know, there's scenes like Seattle had a scene, but Seattle, all the bands were sort of the same, you know, and there's the Twin Cities, you know, they had a scene, and Boston had a scene, and Athens, Georgia had a scene. So there's always been scenes around, but Deep Ellum was the most diversified, eclectic of the artistic, sonic diversity of any scene that's been in America.
Well, so we go from the 30s and the blues and the uniqueness that Deep Ellum offered for that. Then we go to the 80s, where you kind of mirror that whole I want to be unique, I want to be me type of thing. Then we go into the 90s, like you said, when I came down here and I saw a bunch of bands, again, mirroring that same feeling. And at some point, you decide to continue that further with, like you said, The Door. What else are we looking at that point? When did The Door open?
Yeah, so The Door opened in 1998. So I was here from like 84 to 93-ish. And I was just sort of burned out on having venues and dealing with, you know, the booking agents and the authorities and the crowd. And I just needed to get away. So I went away for about 5 years out in the middle of nowhere, built a place out in the country. But, you know, the spark hit again. So in 98, we opened The Door. And the policy there was it was all ages.
Exactly.
No alcohol. We just started booking local bands. And it was... What happens is when there's a place like that, the agents find you. So people like Andrew Ellis, you know, in New York, he started sending us stuff like The Anniversary and Dashboard Confessional and The Get Up Kids.
This is exactly what I remember.
Yeah.
Like you said, Deep Ellum did not have a place that was all ages. It did not have a place for somebody to come in who was young and loved music. And I remember when The Door opened and hearing about it and then seeing all these emo acts come in, which at the time, I mean, that's what your 15, 16, 18, 19-year-olds were all listening to. And it was the perfect place for that music at that time. And people loved The Door.
It's kind of funny how you brought us here because, you know, my first venture in Deep Ellum in 84 was kind of like to escape Dallas and create a free place. And then, you know, coming back in 98, it was a little bit different but the same, but was ironic was Deep Ellum had grown up.
Yeah.
So in 95, 96, you know, Deep Ellum was pretty much business as usual. Then we opened the door, and it was another whole thing of all these bands. We had Brand New and Under Oath and Fall Out Boy, first couple of tours. You know, who knew Fall Out Boy would play, you know, in New York on New Year's Eve and become what they've become? So it's just like these agents find a venue, and they start sending you all these really cool bands. But we were really just all about giving locals opportunity. Even back in the 80s, we'd always put locals like Shallow Rain, you know, Three on a Hill, the end, on touring bands that were coming through. So we had this sort of partnership with 462 and putting our bands on at the Bronco Bowl or whatever. And so that happened again in 98 to 2005, 10, you know. Forever Sickest Kids started at the door in Fort Worth. And I was talking to Jonathan the other day, and he told me, I never even knew this. Forever Sickest Kids starts at the door in Fort Worth. They played The Trees and The Door. And they ended up doing a show in front of 60,000 people in Australia where they headlined with Marilyn Manson, you know. And it's like kind of crazy. So what happens is when you have a policy where everybody can do their thing and it's not restricted by the bottom line, you know, it makes for growth, and it makes for artistic growth, and it brings bands out of the woodwork that just are nobodies, that they do their thing and become somebodies. And unfortunately now we're back to a time where AEG and Live Nation control everything. You know, we used to have every band pull their tour bus up at our venues, man, as independent promoter, you know. And now AEG and Live Nation have even small 300 cap venues.
That's true. Yeah.
So they control now the whole booking machine from the band starting out to the major stadiums.
But, you know, I see places like Three Links. There are some places that are still allowing that old school feeling to survive.
That's true. Dada, Three Links, Trees still sort of keep that torch going of Deep Ellum type venues, free type venues. So, and they book mostly independent bands that are on their way up, you know, and that's cool that they are doing that, and they give a place to grow and be, you know, connect and build an audience, build a fan base.
Well, I've got a friend, he's in a kind of harder band. They're called Warhog, and they played a showcase at Trees recently. It was like four bands, and they didn't expect much of it other than, you know, hey, let's get our fans out here and have some fun. And next thing they know, you know, Clinton's calling them up and being like, hey, can I put you on this touring act we want you to open? And it's exciting to see that there are still owners that want to continue what you've been talking about, want to see the locals grow.
Yeah, you know, there's always throughout the whole, I think historically, the kind of guys that want to have venues and keep doing it for a long period of time, they love the music, they love the bands. You can make a living as a venue owner, as a talent buyer, whatever, but you don't get rich doing it. So really you're doing it because you just kind of love the putting on shows and helping all the artists get somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a good side of humanity right there.
Yeah, no, definitely. Let's do this. I think we can go ahead and play another song now. We talked about a variety of bands. I know we mentioned Forever the Sickest Kids. We talked a little bit more about The Rev early on. Boy, there's a few things. Oh, we talked about Peter Schmidt. We talked about Funland. We could pull from just about anything. What do you think? What about some Rev?
You know, honestly, I've got to tell you, my confession is I've been putting on shows for 37 years, and I love music so much. I'm at this phase of my life, I don't like to pick music. I like to be surprised. You know, sometimes I turn on KXT, you know, the station in Dallas, just to see what they're playing.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even put CDs. I don't even put music on anymore because I just want something to come from the outside and I'll like it.
Well, then I'll pick, because I know that The Rev is in the documentary that we're about to talk about. So that'll be a perfect lead-in.
Very
good. Why don't
we
play them? Let's play that.
For sure.
Well, I was working on my farm about 1982, pulling up some corn and a little carrot too. Do low flying aeroplanes about 100 feet high, dropped a bunch of bales or something, and some hit me in the eye.
cut a bale open, and man, was I surprised. Bunch of large size baggies, big white rocks inside. So I took a little sample of my crazy brother Joe. He sniffed it up and kicked his heels, said, Horton, that's some blow. Bales of cocaine falling from a flying plane. I don't know who done dropped them, but I think I'm just the same. Bales of cocaine falling like a pouring rain. My life changed completely, father, no flying plane. So I loaded up them bales in my pick-em-up truck, headed west for Dallas, where I would try my luck. I didn't have a notion if I could sell them there. 30 minutes later, I was a millionaire. Bales of cocaine falling from the flying plane. I don't know who done dropped them, but I think I'm just the same. Bales of cocaine falling like pouring rain. My life changed completely by the low flying planes. Oh, let's fly, Jimbo. And now I am a rich man, but I'm still a farmer too. But I sold my farm in Texas, bought a farm down in Peru. And when I get so homesick, I think I'm going insane. I travel back to Texas in a low-flying plane. Bales of cocaine falling from a low-flying plane. I don't know who done dropped them, but I think I'm just the same. Bales of cocaine falling like the pouring rain. My life changed completely by the low-flying plane.
Yeah, I enjoyed that song. I know right before we started it, we said we were going to talk about the documentary, but we've talked about a few things off the record that I think we should record real quick before we get into that documentary. You were talking about some of the festivals that you've been a part of. You've been talking about taking music outside of Deep Ellum in Fort Worth. I mean, there was a Door in Plano, and where else? Because you had four, right?
Oh, yeah, the Door we opened in 98 in Dallas, and I think it was an answer to the fact that Deep Ellum had really grown up and gotten sort of professional. You know, all the clubs were packed and making money and all that. But the Door was really good for all the new up-and-coming acts. You know, the high school kid bands and all that stuff. I remember we started and, you know, bands come out of the woodwork when you give them that opportunity to play their own original music. There's no pressure about selling beer. We were all ages, no alcohol.
And all four locations were the same way?
Well, in 98, we opened with all ages, no alcohol, in Deep Ellum, down on Elm. It was an opportunity where all the bands that didn't really have a place to play, they were young, they were original, they couldn't fit in maybe playing Trees or something where you were expected to sell a lot of beer, bring 350 people or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a high school band, you can't bring your high school friends there to drink beer.
Yeah, so we opened up and it really hit, you know. And to answer your question, there was such a demand there. And I remember Patrick Keel was a teacher out at Quad C. He taught music.
Sure.
And he's the guy that produced Trippin' Daisy's first record, by the way. But Patrick, he started helping us kind of spread the word at Quad C, and he told some bands about it, and it was, so we just, it just sort of layers. That's when we had all these bands like Lewis. We
oh,
did
yeah.
a record. You know, Lewis was a beautifully superb sounding band, and you know, Aiden Holt was doing One Ton Label,
yeah,
and so
exactly.
He'd do showcases at the Door. So that early 2000 era was really cool. It got very thick, but the fact that we had all these road shows like, you know, Fall Out Boy, Brand New, Under Oath, Get Up Kids. And we had a lot of Christian stuff too, like Mercy Me and David Crowder, you know, 1,500 tickets. It was a beautiful thing. I mean, one night, you know, it'd be a 1,000-foot crutch or something like that. And then the next night was just some super grungy, hardcore, suicidal band, you know. So we mixed it up. And I think the idea was, you know, Fort Worth didn't have a venue. So there was no all-ages venue. So we just started thinking, hey, we need to do a Door Fort Worth. And so we opened up right across from Billy Bob's, you know, in the Stockyards. So it was we didn't fit in, you know, because you had the country bars on the Stockyard Strip and Billy Bob's over there.
But, and a bunch of, like, Mexican restaurants. And
yeah, but by God, we did it anyway, you know. We put the alternative, you know, emo scene over there at the door in Fort Worth.
How big was that venue?
It held about 650.
Okay.
So we had a 10-year run at the door in Fort Worth with, I mean, we had Minus the Bear and, you know, Bowling for Soup played over there. We put some pretty cool acts over there, but what most importantly came out of that was all these local bands in Fort Worth came through the door of Fort Worth, and they could build their following there.
Yeah.
You know, they play the first gig with 40 people, and within a year they'd have 500 fans showing up. So a lot of bands like Forever Sickest Kids and, you know, Analog Rebellion and all these, you know, I can't remember them all now, but there was 5 to 8 significant bands that went on to do great things that came from there. And then we thought, oh, well, what about Plano? So we opened the door of Plano. It was only like 350 cap on like Parker and 75, and it did okay. But I think we've kind of figured out after a year or two that all the kids in Plano wanted to play the Door Deep Ellum.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that great. So yeah, at one time we had 4 doors, and it was a really cool thing. Then our landlord became Westdale. So the guy that was our landlord at the door, the original door, sold it to Westdale, and they said, hey, we're going to knock this down and put up 14-story residence, which is there now at Oakland. No, it's that's Hall and Elm, I guess. And so we're like, okay, so we had to move. We moved into the old Gypsy Tea Room space. So we reopened the Profit Bar on Elm Side in the Gypsy Tea Room, and we opened the door in the Gypsy Ballroom. And so we just, you know, put up our signs and started booking our stuff and took the place over. And so that became, you know, a really vibrant situation. Agents were sending us acts. You know, we booked something like Dua Lipa, you know, in the Profit Bar, and the tickets would sell out today. So we'd move it to the door, ended up selling 1,000 tickets, and nobody knew who she was. So you could see Dua Lipa for $20. I remember Chris Yeomans brought the Lumineers in, same thing. Sold out in one day, moved it to the bigger room. What another thing that was cool at the Profit Bar in the door is R.C. Williams did his jam session every Wednesday night at the Profit Bar. And R.C., he's Erica Badu's band director.
Okay.
So Erica would do her birthday parties at the door every year for a long time before she moved them to the Bomb Factory. And Leon Bridges, you know, he's like doing the open mic jam session, got his deal with Columbia at the Profit Bar on a Wednesday night. So much comes out of venues when the philosophy is it's for the artists, it's for the bands to be free to do their thing their way. And that's what art's all about. You know, when it's contrived and it's just for the sake of money, it's not really going to amount to much.
Well, I think that's a good philosophy to have. I know for a fact, because I've talked to so many people, that the door was a major part of their life. It was what allowed them to dive into live music, and I think that's a good thing. But you had mentioned too earlier, before we started recording, about a really cool outdoor event that you were a part of. Why don't you tell our listeners about that? Because I had no clue about this one.
Oh, right. Yeah, let's get there. First, I wanted to say, you know, the battle of the bands at the door. If you look back now on the people that came through the battles, St. Vincent, you know.
Yeah, of course.
She pretty much started at a battle of the bands at the door. Sarah Jaffe played the door when she was early on. I remember Jonathan Tyler and the Northern Lights. He had a band called Clemency. And they're just the cutest teenage kid, you know, and he ends up being Jonathan Tyler. So it's been cool to see how artists grow when they've got the place to do it. And, you know, it's, I hate to use the word nurture, but, you know, when the fans and the venue and the parents, it's a community that nurtures artists up, you know, whether it's Rhett Miller the whole scene in Deep Ellum at one time just took Rhett Miller under their wing. And he's like the coolest songwriter out there, you know? So it's cool to see that process.
Yeah, I'd say so. It's like you were the greenhouse for all these little seedlings in a way. They needed that. And can you imagine how much different life would be without a St. Vincent, without Annie? Can you imagine, you know, I mean, think about all the different things that Sarah's done. Think about all the different things that Jonathan's done. That kind of talent needs a place to play. And, I mean, like you were saying earlier about the corporate bookers, the kind of entities that don't allow that. I mean, that kind of sucks.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if it's not for people with some resolve and some guts and some, you know, the Mavericks of the world, then everything's going to be, you go, you try to get on The Voice,
yeah,
and then you get your deal, and then you're Taylor Swift. Otherwise, you ain't got nothing. You're just going to be out there singing to your friends in the backyard.
Well, I think I want to get to this documentary. I want to get to this outdoor festival. You got too many stories. Let's do this.
Oh, so we're talking about the Change Your Life Festival.
Yes.
Yeah, so Brianna just walked in, and we're talking about the Deep Ellum Community Arts Festival. And so we had a flashback to the Change Your Life Festival before you were old enough to walk in Deep Ellum in 93. Back in the old days, in 87, all the bands were sort of beginning to chameleon to get record deals. Okay, so Island, Kim Bowie comes in and does the Island compilation, and you know, you had about 10 bands on there that were surefire to get their deals. So all the bands that didn't get their deal, they're like, man, we need to do something to get a record deal, you know. So we had a meeting with like 60 bands. We're like, okay, you guys need to be who you are, stay individual, you know, don't try to contort to be something that's already signed. You know, don't let the music business get to you, okay? So we'll do this big festival. We'll pool the money together and make records on our own. So, you know, the New Bohemians, the Loco Gringos, Reverend Horton Heat, Shallow Rain, all the bands, the Daylights, that were part of the scene at that time, and I'm forgetting 50 others, or for the sake of time, we can't mention the 50 others. We pooled together this gig, and I was dating this Italian girl, Anna, and so I was like, Tim Sanders, hey man, I got to go to Europe for a while, organize this thing and put it together. Tim Sanders is amazing. So he organized the festival. Q102, the radio station that wasn't ever as cool as the Zoo, okay, they picked up on it though. Redbeard and the whole Q102 brigade, they just took it and they talked about it constantly for 10 days. And 20,000 people show up on Commerce Street for 60 bands,
that,
you know.
That must have been a sight.
Yeah, so we got the special use permit. We blocked Commerce, and we blocked Crowdus. And it was the biggest thing that had ever happened in Deep Ellum by 1987. And so literally 20,000 people were there. It was a big thing. And the Loco Gringos parked their camper on the front sidewalk at the Profit Bar, which was the sort of the hub of the scene. And we're like, oh, we'll sell a lot of beer or whatever. We didn't sell anything because the Gringos sold beer to the whole festival somehow and T-shirts and didn't give us any money. Didn't have a liquor license either, by the way. So that
was. Yeah, but I understand that's kind of how they did everything.
The Loco Gringos were the epitome of Deep Ellum renegades, and it was a blast. It really was Woodstock every week. So the festival went off. It was beautiful. Everything was great. Then we started. We had some meetings like, okay, what are we going to do with the money? We've got to make the records. And I was trying to keep everybody unified. Like, and some of the bands like, oh, just give us our. So if you divide like 15 grand by 60 bands, it's not a lot of money, right? So I was like, you know, some of the bands are like, just give us our $135. And I'm like, what are you going to do with that? You know, let's keep it together, make a record and whatever. So anyway, then next I had some changes in my own personal life. You know, my black janitor took me to his apartment church in Oak Cliff, and I surrendered to God. And I was like, I don't really want to sell liquor anymore. You know, I kind of want to help and love people. And so the Change Your Life thing kind of fell apart. So then Tim Sanders, who worked for Mark Cuban later, and he's just a super cool guy, he went and did Change Your Life Festival 2 somewhere. I don't know a lot of the details to speak on it, you know. But that's that story. Anyway, it was a monumental moment in Deep Ellum and a turning point, you know. So Russell Hobbs was this guy that, you know, was crazy enough to start in 84, you know, just letting everybody do whatever the hell they wanted. And then my life changed. And I think Deep Ellum shifted in 88, 89 and became even greater. I mean, Deep Ellum hit a whole nother stride it sort of moved from Commerce Street to Elm Street in a way. You know, trees came in later, and it's like the scene just really kicked in.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I can only imagine the number of little anecdotes and stories you've got from that time. It's probably, well, I mean, let's get into it, because it's not probably, it's definitely getting told. It's getting told in your documentary. Let's hear about that.
Yeah, you know, to try to put Deep Elm in a 90 to 100 minute documentary is like, man, I don't have an analogy good enough to challenge the impossibility of that.
Trying to fit an elephant into a Pringles can.
Sounds good, yes. So we've been working for a year and a half. We've interviewed everybody from, you know, all the bands and venue owners. And we've got, you know, Mark Cuban and Reverend Horton Heat, the New Bohemians. And it's gone really well. It's been a lot of fun. And so we're in post-production. Here it is, February 2024. So we're in post-production, and we've come to the realization that, you know, with 50 great interviews, maybe 51 now since we got Jason Janik today.
yeah, we sat down and did a little bit of a video for the documentary.
Yeah, so,
and you had asked for some of my photos because, you know, I documented the mid and late 90s down there. So it's the stuff that you've told me about it so far, it just sounds like it's going to be a great watch.
And the photography is so important. It's another thing that there's no appropriate analogy for how important photography is. You know, the saying, a picture tells a thousand words. Just think how much photography is crucial to document our lives. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So we found out after, you know, 50-something interviews, and everybody's got such good knowledge or information or stories to share. So basically, we're going to come out with a 6 or 7 episode episodic version, and then we're going to boil it down to a 90 or 100-minute feature.
And so we get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and so the people, you know, we're going to get the feature. We're fastly working on it, and we're going to get the feature done and, you know, show it in some festivals, sell it to streaming or whatever. But the people that really want to dig in can see the episodic,
yeah,
and get more of what Tripp and Daisy has to say. You know, Jason Janik, Reverend Horton Heat. So it's going really well, and it's...
Well, and the names you've got, because I'm sure you interviewed Jeff Lyles. I'm sure you interviewed James Bland. I'm sure you interviewed, I mean, the number of people who witnessed things down there from all angles. It's just...
Well, yeah, you can't interview everybody. We do have a lot of people. We do, I feel, have a cross-section of bands, painters, venue owners, scenesters. You know, we've got Billy Bob Thornton talking about how cool Reverend Horton Heat is,
yeah,
and how to be an individual artist, you know. And the theme of the movie really is about is how to be yourself in a world that's constantly trying to make you fit in a mold and get in line. And so we're in the spirit of Deep Elm, we're sort of fighting that still today.
The beauty of it is that it really captures the kind of moments that would be lost to time otherwise. I mean, these are little memories in people's heads that now they're getting to share. Even if you didn't get to see somebody like Toadies, or like you said, I mean, you're talking about the theater gallery days, the stuff that I didn't even get to see. You know, at least now I have some way to pretend I lived through it.
That's
you
right.
Know?
That's right. That's what history's about. History is his story, and that's where we get wise. That's where we learn to have perspective on life.
Yeah.
And to appreciate what we have now. So the past, the present, and the future are all important.
Well, I'm excited for it. I think this is about the time that we normally play our last song, and it's been a delight getting to hear about all this stuff. I mean, as long as I've been coming down here, and I feel like it's been quite a while. I mean, 93 to 2024, that's, you know, that's a few years. And to know that there's still so much more that you can offer that I had no clue about, it's just exciting. I love music. I love Texas music. And to know that people like you have been such a big part of it, it's exciting.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, let's do this. Let's wrap up. You said you're not big on picking songs, so I'm going to pick something.
You sure you don't want to do Deep Ellum Blues a cappella?
You know, I've got a 78. I think it's the Shelton Brothers, and they sing Deep Ellum Blues.
Nice.
And it's just a joy to discover all that old stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many Texas bands from so many generations. I don't know. It's like Christmas every day when I find something new. You mentioned a good 40 or 50 bands this last segment, and there was one that you mentioned in the beginning of this segment that really caught my ear, because I had a friend who's head over heels for Lewis. She went to like every Lewis show. She gave out Lewis CDs to friends as gifts, and I understand why, because I mean, Lewis was cool. They have this one song. I'm going to pick that song to go out on.
Beautiful. Love it.
People who don't know Lewis, they need to know Lewis.
They do.
Well, thank you very much. This was fun. I think the listeners enjoyed it. I know I did. We got some more shows coming up. So thanks, Russell.
Thanks for having me. I'll be back anytime.
All right. Let's hear some Lewis. Bye.
Someone left to blame.